Hi, everyone, and welcome to the OLR podcast. My name is Ronald.
And my name is Sean.
And we are two associate editors on the Ottawa Law Review. This episode is part of a series where we interview authors who have published articles with the Ottawa Law Review. Today, we'll be speaking with Kristen Thomason about her article titled Robots, Regulation, and the Changing Nature of Public Space, which was published in Volume 51, Issue 2 of the OLR. Just a reminder, the OLR is an open access journal, and this article is accessible on the OLR website. So, if you have not done so already, you can access the article there.
Kristen Thomason is an assistant professor at the Peter A. Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia, where she teaches robotics law and society and tort law. Her research covers a range of technology law topics, including robotics, artificial intelligence, and privacy. Her most recent article, titled Safety in Artificial Intelligence and Robots Governance in Canada, was published in the Canadian Bar Review's special 100th anniversary volume. In addition to her research and teaching, Kristen frequently shares her expertise in the media and serves as a member of the Legal Expertise Committee of the Foundation for Responsible Robotics and the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. While Kristen now works at UBC, she also has a close connection to Ottawa. She earned both her JD and her PhD in law at the University of Ottawa. Between completing her JD and her PhD, Kristen was a law clerk at the Alberta Court of King's Bench and then at the Supreme Court of Canada for the Honorable Justice Rosalie Abella. Kristen holds an honors BA in anthropology from McMaster University and an MA in international affairs from Carleton University.
Robots are an increasing common feature in North American public spaces. From regulations permitting broader drone use in public airspace and autonomous vehicles testing on public roads to delivery robots roaming on sidewalks in major U.S. cities, the laws regulating North American public spaces are opening up to robots. In many of these examples, the growing presence of robots in public space is associated with opportunities to improve human lives through intelligent urban design, environmental efficiency, and greater transportation accessibility. However, the introduction of robots into public space has also raised concerns about, for example, the commercialization of these spaces by companies that deploy robots, increasing surveillance that will negatively impact physical and data privacy, or the potential marginalization or exclusion of some members of society in favor of those who can pay to access, use, or support the new technologies available in these spaces. Laws that permit, regulate, or prohibit robotic systems in public spaces will in many ways determine how this new technology impacts public space and the people who inhabit that space. This begs the questions: how should regulators approach the task of regulating robots in public spaces? And should any special considerations apply to the regulation of robots because of the public nature of the spaces they occupy?
Kristen Thomason's paper argues that the laws that regulate robots deployed in public space will affect the public nature of that space, potentially to the benefit of some human inhabitants of the space over others. For these reasons, special considerations should apply to the regulation of robots that will operate in public space. In particular, the entry of a robotic system into a public space should never be prioritized over communal access to and use of that space by people. And where a robotic system serves to make a space more accessible, lawmakers should avoid permitting differential access to that space through the regulation of that robotic system.
I
Okay, welcome, Kristen. We're excited to have you joining us today on the OLR podcast. Your research touches on some really interesting areas in law and technology. And I think I speak for Ronald and I both when I say the article you published has been quite popular with the OLR podcast team here.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
So we wanted to start with your time at the University of Ottawa. You completed your PhD at the University of Ottawa, and your dissertation focused on public space privacy intrusions that are facilitated by robots and artificial intelligence. And so we were wondering how you first became interested in this area of research.
I became interested in this area back when I was in law school at Ottawa. So I did my JD at Ottawa as well. And I started my JD with a huge interest in online privacy and especially on social media. And through that, I became connected with Ian Kerr, who was just an absolute wonderful professor, human being who was at University of Ottawa. And I was so fortunate and continue to be so grateful that he essentially became my mentor and friend. When I was in law school, I had the privilege of being a research assistant with him through, I can't remember the name now, but there's an RA process to get into tech law at University of Ottawa, which I fully recommend to anyone who's in law school at Ottawa now. And he was really ahead of things in terms of robotics, automation, thinking about this long before sort of the, you know, the very broad focus that we're starting to see increasingly now today. And so through doing research with him, I was exposed to a range of different kinds of legal issues and, engaging a range of different kinds of robotic systems and automation. And my interest just continued to grow. And so that's ultimately what led me into my PhD in this space. And then I've just sort of continued from there. So I give a lot of credit to Ian and his foresight in terms of how significant automation is going to become and is now. Like, we can really see it now, especially for the law, for our legal rights, for how, you know, we vision justice. And that was how I got into this area.
That's so amazing to hear, Kristen. To provide a bit of context for our audience and the different topics we're about to dive into, can you explain to the audience what public space means in the context of your paper and why is that relevant and important?
Absolutely. So when I started thinking about, you know, robotics and particularly like the spatial and legal importance of robotic systems, I was sort of starting from a place of like, oh, well, public space is just, you know, space that's not private property, right? And then I started digging into this more deeply. And there's a really rich and incredibly interesting literature and like area of thinking in what is called law and geography. It's an interdisciplinary area of study that looks at this intersection of law with space, with the people and the things that exist in that space. And it's incredibly fascinating. And as I sort of dug into some of the thinking and theorizing in that space, I came to a better understanding, I would say, of what actually makes a space a public space. And so you see this in the paper a little bit as well, but you know, first of all, there's the legal designation. So, you know, that instinct of thinking, you know, is a space a public space? Public space isn't private property with all these private rights to exclude trespass rights, other sort of policing and enforcement rights that can be associated with owning private property. You know, there's truth to that for sure. But the legal status of a space as a public space is only a component of whether or not that space is truly a public space in the meaning or sense that, you know, members of the public get to use and make access to that space. Another important aspect of a public space is its actual physical accessibility. So, you know, you could have a public park, quote unquote, but if it's fenced off and the fences are all locked, which is something that we've, you know, for instance, seen here, I live now in Vancouver, that we've seen here in Vancouver in some parks in different occasions, that space is no longer truly a public space. Like, you know, there might not be a a private owner who can tell you that you're trespassing, but the space itself is no longer physically accessible. So physical barriers, the actual ability to access and use the space is also a component of that understanding of whether a space is public. And then something that this, truly, I think is examined quite deeply in law and geography, but something else that is really important to assessing whether a space is a public space is how behavior and conduct is regulated within that space. So if conduct or activities or interactions or things, items like robots are regulated in a way that actually exclude people or things, but I'm more interested in sort of the people and our lived experiences. So it could be the operators of robot systems, or it could be people in different contexts. If they're excluded from that space, that actually reduces the sort of public nature or public understanding of that space because people have been excluded and marginalized. So it might be public for some and less public for others. If we're really thinking about public space as a communal and shared space that's open for all of us to use. And I think the pandemic has certainly reminded us of how important it is that we have these sort of shared communal outdoor spaces. And so thinking about it through sort of those different layers of what makes a space a public space, I have found to be really helpful in, especially in the research that we're talking about today.
That's great. Yeah, I would say, for me reading your paper as well, this was my first introduction to thinking about public space this way. And it was interesting thinking about how a space can be more or less public. And it's not just about who owns the space or that it's designated as public, but what are the different rules and regulations that apply, and how might those apply differently to different people or different activities that are being undertaken in that space. So we have a few questions about changes since 2020. Your article with the Ottawa Law Review was published in 2020. And since then, some of the projects that planned to introduce robots into public spaces in Canada, which you mentioned in the article, such as Toronto Smart City, have been rejected or otherwise canceled. So what are you seeing now as the current trends around robots in public spaces in North America? And have any new or interesting projects or use cases emerged in the last couple of years that you think listeners should know about?
It's a great question. And a lot has changed and a lot has stayed the same since the pandemic in 2020. I mean, during the pandemic, certainly I was paying close attention because what else was I doing? I was paying close attention to the ways that robots and robotic, like automated systems were being used to respond to the realities, I suppose, or the concerns around the pandemic. So, I mean, an obvious example of that, this isn't fully a public space in the way that I talk about, but was, we saw this growing use of robots in hospitals to avoid doctor to patient contact. There could be like a telepresence robot or something operated in between. And, something that was really notable to me was the use of different kinds of automated systems like drones to surveil public spaces and tell people to maintain social distance or to go home after a curfew, which felt very dystopian, I think, to a lot of people, certainly to myself. And so we saw, that this idea that automation can distance people, I think, really highlighted during the early stages of the pandemic. But we haven't seen that, thankfully, I think, we haven't really seen that continue, at least not as sort of overt and obviously over the years that have followed. I would say, though, not so much in res I know your question is about like what new systems might we see, but I would say what I've really noticed in taking a turn since the pandemic is on the one hand, what I mentioned before, like this real sort of embrace or different understanding of the value of a lot of public and communal spaces, and also of the value of being able to gather in safe ways or safer ways. But then also a real turn, this is anecdotal, but my observation, especially in Canada, has been a real turn in how municipalities and other sort of government bodies think about public space. And this is, I'm jumping a little ahead, but this is something that I talk about in the paper. This like way that lawmakers and policymakers understand public space can really shape how they regulate things that happen there. And I've really noticed quite a rise in the vision of cities as like, well, we own public spaces, so we're going to decide who gets to be there, how people get to use it. We can kick people out using trespass laws, analogous to what a private property owner would use. I personally find that very concerning, and I think that's something that really grew in the pandemic and has now continued on. But in terms of actually thinking about the systems, I think at least in Canada, we've sort of seen the end of the drone hype cycle, which I find nice. Like, there was a period of time where drones were very sort of clickbaity in the media, and there were a lot of sort of really hyped up stories about drones. But now, we're seeing, I think, more of an integration of drones through drone laws, drone regulations into airspace in a way that is more gradual and a little more constrained than what I think some of the hype had us worried about before the pandemic. We've certainly seen a lot more sidewalk delivery robots introduced in sort of experimental ways in Canada, a little bit of expansion of the testing of automated vehicles, although that too has been more gradual than I think the early hype would have wanted people to imagine. And the last sort of big development, at least in Canada, big to my mind, interesting and important, I think, to my mind, was legal development. There was a sidewalk robot delivery company operating in Toronto, or maybe there were more. There was at least one. And it prompted the city council to consider whether or not they should be regulating how sidewalk robots operate on and interact with people on public sidewalks. And just very briefly, I mean, you can find more online certainly about what happened here, but the city council was really open, it seemed, to hearing from affected stakeholders, including accessibility groups that really, portrayed for city council the concern that public sidewalks would become less public or not accessible to all members of the public in an equitable way if you have these large, clunky, sometimes prone to failure sidewalk robots operating all over downtown Toronto public sidewalks. And city council actually put in sort of a temporary pause on the presence of those sidewalk robots in the city. So it's sort of the opposite of what I know you're asking, but it was a really interesting legal development, especially considering it seemed to really be framed around the idea that public sidewalks should be for everyone. And if something's going to interfere with that, we need to think closely about, how we regulate that. And it didn't strike me as like this is a permanent ban. It seemed very much more like this is a temporary measure until we can figure this out so that it can be more equitable or whether it can be more equitable. So those were some of the things that I really noticed. I think the biggest of which is this shift in how lawmakers think about, what is public space and how they should regulate it.
So, in your article, you also speak about a number of potential benefits to having robots in public spaces, and also a number of potential risks or downsides. So, I think that example you just shared about delivery robots and the sidewalks is a good example. What do you see as the key benefits being touted by those who want robots in public spaces? And what are the key downsides or risks that we need to be aware of?
I think, well, right now, or over the past decade or so, actually, I would say those who have been most vocally touting the value of robots in public space have often been commercial industry. And I would say that usually the benefits there are really framed around sort of commercial or profit-based goals. So I've seen a lot with all different types of systems. I've seen a lot of promotion of like, oh, things can be more efficient. We could take delivery trucks off the road and replace them with, sidewalk robots or automated vehicles or drones or whatever the case might be. But really framed around sort of like an efficiency, replacing human workers with robotic systems, like those kinds of goals and supposed benefits. I would say a lot of those benefits really deserve to be questioned and examined closely, and whether or not that's I can, with a consideration of whether or not that's just a commercialization of what should be a space for everybody. There's a bit of a discussion in the paper, if folks read it, about this vision that sidewalks are meant, like there's one vision that sidewalks are meant to help people get efficiently from one business to the next. And I hope many would pause and step back and think, like, is that really what sidewalks are for? Like, sometimes sidewalks are for gathering or for meeting up with friends or for going for a casual stroll, not necessarily driven in any way by commercial interests or profit. So I think the most sort of vocal group have been pushing sort of that approach to the benefits. But I think that there are a lot of really interesting ways that robot systems being introduced into public space change and bring benefits to the use of public spaces. And the most sort of obvious example that jumps out to me has been the use of drones for journalism and for citizen journalism. So the ability to gain access to footage that previously would only have been available to, say, like a large news company that might have owned a helicopter, or policing agencies that would have a helicopter or access to an airplane, is now more accessible to individuals who can operate smaller and far less expensive drones. I mean, I'm not trying to say drones aren't still expensive, but certainly a lot less than a helicopter. And so that has been a really interesting development in my mind. And then, of course, there's also a lot of really interesting sort of hypothetical, and I think near future, promising applications of robotics. I've seen a lot of different types of research, geared towards accessibility. As a person who had twins and pushed around two children in a stroller for a long time, like I've seen some research initiatives that are really directed at sort of making cities more accessible with wheels. And I think that there's a lot of promise in that kind of work. It really depends on what is the ultimate goal. Like, is the ultimate goal actually accessibility, or is the ultimate goal profit and commercialization and efficiency? And I think, we can be pretty critical about approaching some of those projects and thinking about, will this really benefit the public, or is this the use of public space to benefit a company? And I'm not saying that cannot happen. That obviously does happen already in public space, but just that I think there needs to be a lot of care and consideration, especially from policymakers, around what is the actual benefit that might come from this, and is that in the public interest? There's a bit of a risk of a sort of, public space is just there for the taking. It's not privately owned. So, companies or commercial interests can use it however they see fit. And I think there's, I'm happy to recommend readings, but there's a lot of really interesting critical work on this vision of public space as a property or approached with a colonial mindset that we see echoed in some of these promotions of different robot systems. But I think there is a lot of genuinely interesting work going on as well.
And I think I'm pulling a quote from your article, and I think the readers, the audience, can have a better understanding of what you have just discussed. So your quote says, "The entry of a robotic system into a public space should never be prioritized over communal access to and use of that space by people. And where a robot system serves to make a space more accessible, lawmakers should avoid permitting differential access to that space through the regulation of that robotic system." Are you able to elaborate on these two points for the audience and perhaps provide one or two examples of where you see issues that might arise?
Absolutely. So these are sort of the two, this is almost like the framework, or like the two big takeaways that I suggest, based on this examination of how robot regulation can make public space more or less accessible, or more or less public, sorry, which can include access, but there's a whole range of ways in which that publicness can be affected. And so with the first, so this idea that a robot system should never be prioritized over communal access to and use of a space by people, there are a range of different examples of how that has been, how that has arisen already with different robotic systems. There's a couple of examples from the US that are in the paper. And there's also a lot of hypothetical examples that we could imagine and how this might happen. What I would say as, you know, sort of the more straightforward example is we could imagine things like human conduct. So the conduct of people in public spaces being regulated in a way that is meant to either protect these expensive robots that are operating in space, that is meant to, you know, purportedly protect people from robots that can sometimes do things that are unexpected and that might be harmful, or that is meant to sort of surveil or criminalize people who might try to interfere with robot systems in public space. These are all regulations, or these would all be examples of regulations that seem almost maybe neutral in terms of like public space, public access. On their face, because it's really just about regulating conduct vis-a-vis a robot, sometimes from, you know, what might seem like a very good motivation, like protecting physical safety. But when you take that breakdown that we talked about earlier of what makes a space more or less public, and the ways in which behavior and conduct can be regulated in public space actually reduces the sort of public nature or public dynamic of a space. You can imagine things like if people's conduct is being regulated on sidewalks in order to create more predictability for sidewalk robot systems. I have not seen an example of that specifically, but it's sort of a hypothetical that could be imagined in the near future. That regulation might really have a negative impact on the public nature of space. Like we lose this ability to use and have some spontaneity on public sidewalks. You know, we have seen, especially in the United States, a lot of instances of either new regulations or just strict enforcement of existing regulations against people who have interfered with robot systems. So like automated vehicles or sidewalk robots, or these like policing robots called Nightscope. If anyone's seen them, they're like a large cone that rolls around and has cameras on it, and a few instances of those being vandalized. And so these would all be examples to me where, even though it might not be the intention behind the regulations are actually prioritizing the system and protecting the system rather than thinking about, you know, what do people want in this space or how do people make use of this space? What's an equitable approach to this space, which might mean actually excluding the robot instead of excluding or heavily regulating people. Sally Applin has some great work. She's an anthropologist on the ways that robots sort of interfere with people's ability to just use and make use of space and how robots call on people to do a lot of work for them. Like when ro sidewalk robots get caught on a bump in a sidewalk, a person now has to move it out of the way to keep it going. Otherwise, it blocks the whole sidewalk. So thinking about, you know, rules that allow sidewalk robots to operate but don't take into account the impact on people fall into that category. The second proposal is that where a system makes a space accessible, that system shouldn't be differentially regulated in a way that allows some people to get access and not others. At least not, you know, without, I concede, of course, that there could be scenarios under like a Section 1 of the Charter type analysis where there might be a legitimate justification in a particular case, but it shouldn't be the default that if a robot is the reason people can access a public space, that only some people get to use that robot in certain ways and not others. So again, that'd be an example where what seems like just the regulation of a robot actually becomes the regulation of a public space altogether. And I think drones and access to airspace is a really important example there. So, you know, most of us can't access airspace. You know, of course, like you could rent a helicopter, or if you're incredibly wealthy, you might own like a plane or something that allows access to airspace. But most people can't really access sort of a low airspace without some kind of technical system. And drones have really become one very obvious example of how people can now make access to low airspace. And so I cite in the paper some examples. The readers can get more details if they want to look at that paper, but where drones have been used to collect video footage over protests, particularly in the United States, and have sometimes collected video footage of police brutality against protesters. In particular, there's an example of the use of a drone by a citizen journalist at Standing Rock in North Dakota during the No DAPL resistance movements, when police used water cannons on the people who were set there resisting this oil pipeline in the late at night in November, when that would have been freezing cold. And the video footage had a really important impact on the public's response to what was happening at Standing Rock. And the FAA, which is the United States equivalent of our Transport Canada, which regulates drones and airspace, imposed these limitations so that only certain drone operators could access public airspace with a drone and not others, effectively limiting, citizen journalists, protesters, the indigenous communities that live in Standing Rock, or others that had come to resist this oil pipeline from accessing airspace, but allowing police to use drones to access airspace for surveillance purposes. And they did allow one non-local journalist to use a drone. So that, to me, was an example of this differential regulation of a robot system. And it was sort of framed as like, oh, we're just regulating drones. It's not like we're excluding people from public space. I'm paraphrasing. They didn't say that exactly, but it was sort of framed in that way. But if you break it down, if you break down what makes a space public in this sort of law and geography approach that I've proposed, you can start to see how this is actually excluding people from a public space, like a space that is in theory there for everybody. And airspace is very heavily regulated in terms of what you can do in that space. And I think airspace might, in the near future, this is my thinking, might become an increasingly important and significant public space, and hopefully will push us towards, as a society, deeper thinking about what it means for airspace to be a public space. But yeah, that would be one. To me, that felt like a really clear example where differential regulation actually excludes people from a space. And imagining something similar to that happening on the ground, it would feel to me very clear that it would be infringing on First Amendment in the US or in Canada, our freedom of expression rights that are protected under the Charter. So, yeah.
Great. Yeah, I think an interesting aspect of the drone example that you speak about as well is that drones actually kind of made airspace a public space in the first place, in the sense that there was more access to airspace for kind of everyday people who have money for a drone. And then we see this regulatory response. And it seems like a lot of the examples you're giving, the regulations or the thinking about how public space is affected is happening after the fact, because these technologies are, being introduced and developed so quickly. And I was wondering if you find that the people who are developing and promoting robotics projects in public spaces, if they, during the development stage of these technologies, are, if you find that those people are consciously engaging with these ideas, these broader legal or social questions about the nature of public spaces, or if it's mostly just a conversation that happens after the fact and is maybe pushed forward by people who are not the ones who are introducing these robots into public spaces.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say, just from my research, so it's not to say there aren't other examples out there that I'm not aware of, or where maybe it's not public knowledge what the developing company was thinking about. But from a lot of the examples that I've seen, rather than there being sort of a what seems like a thinking about or in deep a deep engagement about, public space and the value or importance of public space, what I see more of is examples where developers have really tried to push, either through lobbying or through other efforts, to sort of grab public space for themselves, so to speak. So an example of that is in the US, a number of cities were regulating sidewalk robots, following lobbying from a sidewalk robot company. And the laws that were designating, what size and what speed and what sort of appearance the sidewalk robot had to have were very much premised around this one particular company's design, seemingly with an eye to excluding potentially some other companies. Like the weight would fit with the weight of this one company's product and would be less than, a heavier competitor. So now the competitor is technically not allowed to operate because the sidewalk law says that they have to be under a certain weight. Or, that's one example, but there are cases where we sort of see this approach to public space, which to me very much sort of contravenes the idea of public space as this, communal and shared area for the public benefit or public interest. I mean, I have heard from municipalities that they have looked at this research and thought through this research in the development of their municipal bylaws, which is, first of all, as a researcher, incredibly exciting and wonderful to hear. But secondly, it doesn't surprise me that it would be the policymakers who would be thinking more deeply about, what is this space? What do we want it used for? Sort of the higher level, theory of the space, I guess you could say. It doesn't surprise me that that would be the case. I mean, I'm happy to hear that it's the case because I don't think it always is, but I haven't seen an instance, again, not to say there isn't one out there, but I haven't seen an instance where a robot designed by sort of a commercial company, at least, was really done with a view to public space. That said, I mentioned earlier that there are some different research projects that I've seen that are underway where the technology hasn't necessarily been introduced yet. They're more driven by, either non-governmental research, like NGO type research or university type research that are more driven by the notion of making public space more accessible or easier to navigate the sort of physical barriers that exist in public spaces. So, I think that exists, but I suspect it would vary from company to company whether developers are really thinking about that deeply.
And expanding on that point exactly, as you said, it's private companies, it's private developers that are introducing these robots into public spaces rather than government, rather than municipal bodies or federal government bodies. Given that these projects are often promoted for the public interest and are capable of addressing these barriers to access, what legal obligations do you foresee that these private commercial entities must incur in order to see that their projects proceed?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. Especially when a project is promoted and sort of facilitated through law in the public interest, there ought to be sort of a tort law type answer to this, I think, at least in part, like responsibility where something goes wrong, where somebody is injured. Whether that be a physical injury or another kind of harm, like including where like somebody's experienced exclusion from public space due to the presence of the robotic system or the way it's worked or maybe failed to work properly. There have been instances, for example, in the United States where someone was injured by I don't know why sidewalk robots are really on the top of my mind today, but that's the example I'm thinking of where somebody was injured by a sidewalk robot and had a very difficult time getting any, even getting an answer from the company, let alone getting any sort of compensation or accountability. And then, of course, we've seen, again, mainly from US examples, but we've seen instances where automated vehicles that are being tested on public roads have injured or sometimes killed pedestrians. And again, in those cases, I tried to follow as closely as I could with what was available publicly. And we often see that the company will settle with the family of the pedestrian or with the pedestrian themselves if they're injured but not killed. But it raises a lot of really important questions to me about, who gets to use public space and really, like, through what kind of consultation mechanism do they go to use public space to advance or further research and development that is, maybe proposed to be in the public interest, but that is ultimately, especially when it's done through sort of a commercial entity that is ultimately geared towards profit and profitability. So, like in those automated vehicle examples, you know, it's pedestrians and it's other drivers of the road who are taking on the risk without really having any meaningful opportunity to consent or agree to that. And it's the company that's going to benefit as the car improves in its skills and abilities to navigate around public space. You know, I've done some work on a project that's still sort of forthcoming with a roboticist from the US. Her name is Cindy Grimm. And we've been thinking about things like, you know, taxing and financial contributions from companies that use public space in order to, you know, engage in their research and development processes, and how might law be one of perhaps many other mechanisms to ensure that companies that are earning profit are sending that profit back to the public, especially if the system is permitted or promoted in the basis that, you know, having this system is going to be in the public interest. Just to make that a little more concrete, what I'm saying, like things like automated vehicles are allowed to test on public roads, because there is this sort of overarching vision that automated vehicles are in the public interest, like having better automated car technology is in the public interest because it'll reduce traffic accidents, it will reduce you know, injuries and fatalities due to driving. And as a side note, I would say there's been some really interesting critiques of that assumption, because it's not really proven. It's more of like a hypothetical, like, oh, it's common sense that automated vehicles will reduce collisions. So, I mean, if any listeners are interested in thinking more deeply, you can find some really compelling critiques of that. But, you know, thinking more about how the public actually benefits, and really importantly, something that we are not seeing, at least not in Canada, is how does the public get to have any input or say into what kind of systems are introduced into public spaces? I guess in theory, it's through voting for your city council, but it's hard to do that when a lot of this is sort of hypothetical or near future. And so I think, you know, having more mechanisms for getting a sense of what is important in different spaces will be crucial to actually having systems that are in the public interest. The Toronto sidewalk robot example, I think, is a really nice example of listening to and hearing the public's concerns, and then using the law to sort of respond to that in a meaningful way.
That's great. Yeah, I think we'll try to maybe in the podcast notes link to some of the further research or papers or things that you've mentioned so far. And just digging a bit deeper into some of these projects that are in the public interest potentially. One of the examples that's maybe more directly in the public interest potentially compared to, say, self-driving cars, where the benefit is a little more maybe high level or abstract at this point, is some of these projects which focus on increasing accessibility of spaces. For example, I don't know if this was in Canada or somewhere else, but there was an example in the paper of robotic systems which can assist people with vision or mobility impairments in crossing busy streets. So projects like this, knowing that in Canada, individuals have existing legal rights to barrier-free public spaces. Do you think that using robots to make spaces more accessible would further these rights, or could it potentially undermine that existing legal right to a barrier-free space or perpetuate ableism?
I think that's a really important question, and I think it's a question that we, as those, you know, working in the law or interested in the law, and as members of the public, need to sort of keep asking when it comes to these proposals, and when it comes to the legal response to these proposals. I think a big risk with robot systems in this regard is that the promises that they're offering, like the sort of potential or benefit that they're offering, is very individualized. So the proposals make it almost like an individual responsibility or choice to use or gain access to a robot as an aid. And the big risk here, to me, in my eyes, is that it turns away, or it may threaten to turn away focus from, you know, the bigger structural, architectural, and systemic changes that are needed to actually ensure access in a range of different ways to public spaces. So it should never be the case in my mind that, instead of having, an actually accessible barrier-free space, people are expected to just use robots to navigate the barriers that exist, or the barriers that might be constructed with a justification that, oh, I'll just use robots to overcome those barriers. And this would kind of track with my first caution that we were talking about earlier, that, robot systems should never be prioritized over human access to spaces. If robots are now making the space less public to people who could otherwise use it without a robot, just by the, existence or presence of this option, like, oh, you could just use a robot to do this, so we don't need to design the space in a more human-centric way. I think that that raises a lot of concerns, especially because robots have a lot of limits that, I don't often see discussed in a lot of the research about their benefits, which I'm not denying their benefits by saying this. I'm just sort of contextualizing them. But like, I mean, I have a drone, and I've had the opportunity to interact with a number of other robotic systems, and I would say, there's a lot of opportunity for failure. Battery power is limited. Many systems would need access to the internet, and that's not always guaranteed. There's security concerns when you start integrating robots more into day-to-day life. And none of this is even talking about the broader sort of, planetary impact of building more and more robots that is more of a systemic concern as well. So, I mean, I think there is a lot of promise. This is not to say that there isn't opportunity to use automation in ways that can be really beneficial to people for a whole range of different purposes or functions. But I think your question really goes to an important consideration that needs to be front of mind when we're talking about robots making spaces more accessible, which is, is there any risk that this is actually going to substitute for proper systemic or social change that would truly make a space more accessible to people, and that would really much more thoroughly and equitably fulfill that right to barrier-free spaces.
Thank you, Kristen. And speaking of concerns, so you mentioned concerns of security concerns, planetary impacts. You also mentioned about privacy concerns in your paper about the use of the robots in public spaces and going beyond just regulating, physical privacy and the presence of robots in the public space. What can you speak about the state of the law regarding the collection and use of data to perhaps maybe train these robots or to develop these robots in that process and some concerns that you have with that?
Absolutely. So the state of the law with respect to privacy in public is very interesting. and not, as you can tell from my inflection, maybe not always in the best way. I would say in terms of like commercial operators, so right now, PIPEDA, the Personal Information Protection of Electronic Documents Act, regulates commercial collection and use of information, at least like that's sort of the federal regulation. And then, there's a lot of nuance to that sort of commercial collection and use of information, but that's sort of the primary statute that regulates that. And it does apply whether you're in public or in private space. So it's not spatially limited like a lot of other laws are, which I'm happy to talk about in a second. And so, that's important. PIPEDA is likely going to be replaced soon. Bill C-27 is under review within the federal government right now. And if it passes, so if it's adopted, it will amend and change some of what exists right now in terms of the regulation of commercial data collection and processing. And in particular, there are allowances for collecting anonymous information, or like information that's not personal information, so it's not connected to an individual. That is something that is, I would say, it's, it's tricky, it's complicated because of the way AI systems are able to analyze large amounts of data and identify patterns and identify and make predictions, draw out insights about data and information. There is some rightful concern that even if your information is not directly connected to you, it can still have a serious impact on you when that information is collected and analyzed and used in different ways. So there are some, legal considerations around how commercial entities collect and use information. But stepping back from the specific legislation, a lot of my work focuses on privacy in public spaces, including my thesis was focused on privacy in public space, but in tort law. And other than that sort of exception that some of this commercial data collection law applies, even when you're in public space, much of our law in Canada, at least in the common law system, really draws a designation between public and private, where I'm paraphrasing and there's nuance to it. And, if you're very, very interested, you could certainly read my thesis if you wanted a long read. But just to sort of state it quickly, there's an idea that once you've stepped out into public, you've sort of consented to the fact that everyone can see you and so can collect and use your information in different ways with nuance and with some exceptions. But that's sort of a broad generalization. And I think that mindset really is noticeable in how a lot of developers of robotic systems think about how they're going to get the kind of data that they need to train systems that are meant to operate in public space. And so what I mean by that is, like, stepping back even from specific rights, there's this sort of mindset, again, that I've mentioned already, that, well, I can just go and test this car, let's say, in public space because it's public. And so I should just be able to go and test it. And by virtue of that approach or mentality, every person who's out in public space has now become a part of your test or your experiment, whether it's through the collection of their information for the sake of training, whether it's through actually putting them at potentially physical risk, if the vehicle, functions and prop like malfunctions and causes them an injury, or whether it's just through being, implicated in sort of the testing process. And that to me, that mindset to me is it is sort of reflected in our law, like that when you go out into public space, you've sort of agreed to certain things, like being seen by other people. But that law, a lot of those theories of law were created long, 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 long before we had the kinds of data collection and storage capacity that we have today. And so I think this is an example of where bigger theoretical rethinking of our rights and how we share spaces is really important. And, as a researcher, I've engaged with sort of the research ethics guidelines for university researchers in Canada. And I'm not saying that that necessarily has to be a template, but it's really interesting to see how university researchers have these obligations to think really mindfully about who's involved in the research, getting consent, making sure that there's sort of a return, like some kind of benefit goes back to people, even if it's more of a collective public benefit. And I think that kind of thinking is a much more almost collaborative way of thinking than what we see right now, which is a much more, like, for lack of a better word, like a much more entitled thinking. Like, I can just go ahead and do this because the law doesn't say I can't. And I think that that's going to become increasingly concerning if we do see more and more research and development type testing happening in public, where, we members of the public become a part of that corporate development process.
Yeah, and you touched on artificial intelligence, and you touched on the self-driving cars and other autonomous robots. We know that you recently published an article titled, "Safety in Artificial Intelligence and Robots Governance in Canada," which was published in the Canadian Bar Review. And one obvious link that we see, and whenever I think most people think about AI and robots, are these self-driving cars that seem to have, been popping up more and more in the past year or so. What further issues do you foresee when we think about regulating AI-powered robots in our public spaces?
I would say something that's been really interesting in observing Canada's approach to regulating different types of automated systems is that AI has been treated as though it's distinct from robots, from different kinds of robot systems. And the robot systems that we see mainly being regulated and introduced in Canada right now are for the most part being regulated like analogies to other existing but not as heavily automated systems. So automated vehicles are being regulated like cars. And you know, I can understand that analogy. I'm not necessarily like saying, oh, we can't do that, that's wrong. But what's really interesting to me is that like automated vehicles on the road are regulated like cars, but now AI is whatever, you know, that's a very broad term. So like the wide scope of different kinds of systems that the term AI refers to is at, you know, in the same bill that's looking at you know, replacing the existing commercial data regulation, privacy regulation, PIPEDA, that same bill, Bill C-27, is also has a component, which is a law to regulate commercial development and use of artificial intelligence. And something that I've been thinking about since that bill was introduced is how interesting it is to me that it's treating AI like almost like something separate from robotics. Maybe that's not what the regulators intended, but that's at least how I've seen a lot of the sort of conversation and examination of the bill evolving. But the reality is that a lot of these robot systems that we're talking about, like you said, are automated and raise the concerns or challenges or benefits or promises for public space that we've been talking about because they operate on some form of automating software, which would fall usually within the broad scope of what we now call commonly artificial intelligence or colloquially artificial intelligence. And so a lot of this legal development is going to affect robots in public space, or at least I think it ought to. And so I think that at least one of the further issues that arise when we think about regulating AI-powered robots in public space is going to be one of legal, how can I say, like the issue might be one of legal confusion, perhaps. You know, trying to think about how these different legal regimes apply to a system that fits within more than one legal regime, and how do those regimes interact with one another? Does one supersede another in any circumstance? Questions like that. Like, I think we might see the legal sphere potentially getting more and more complicated, which for in-house counsel at robotics development companies, this means a lot of work. For me, as a legal academic, the most important thing that stands out to me is like how and where do our rights, our collective and individual rights, come out, and how do we ensure that they're protected when there are a series of overlapping legal regimes that might apply to a particular kind of system? So, you know, something that is really fascinating is to see how lawmakers, policymakers, members of the public are thinking about AI, are thinking about robots, are thinking about the overlap of AI and robotics, and what all of that is going to mean in terms of how we think about regulating these systems. Right now, I'd say it's like we have silos, like to all the legal audience, law student audience, like how we approach sort of first year law in these silos of like tort law, contract law, criminal law, even though they overlap a lot. Maybe I can make this analogy that we're seeing something similar with like AI law, drone law, automated vehicle law, and all of them overlap in different ways, but we don't really see that overlap considered or discussed. At least I haven't seen it publicly. That's not to say that people aren't thinking about it. And it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
That's great. Yeah, I think a lot of really interesting things to think about looking forward. And we have one final forward-looking question for you. When you think about the future uses of robots and AI in our public spaces, what potential benefits do you feel most optimistic about?
I mean, my really quick answer is examples like the use of drones for journalism or citizen journalism. I find that really interesting. Also, the use of drones for medical aid. I mean, I'm focusing on drones, I think, because we see a lot more real-world examples now of the use of drones. There's lots of near-future examples that are interesting too. But like, you know, drones being used to deliver medication rapidly to respond to things, you know, I used to live in the North Shore of Vancouver, if anyone's familiar with it. There's a lot of sort of search and rescue activity that happens up in the mountains, and the ability to use drones to do that really quickly. Like, there's a lot of really promising ways that this low airspace access can be used, you know? And so I find a lot of that really fascinating and really, I feel optimistic about some of that, especially when it's coming from this public interest place. My honest answer, I don't want to leave us on a pessimistic note. I promise I'll try to turn it into something more positive, but I am increasingly pessimistic in some ways about, you know, I mentioned earlier, like the planetary toll that the development of a range of different automated technologies is taking and increasingly taking, especially when we start to talk about, like, let's get more robots and more AI and more big computer systems. There's a significant impact that is transnational. So, like, we in Canada don't always see or feel the impact that is happening when we start to talk about more automated vehicles, for example. But it is happening and it is affecting others, especially in the global south. So I have a pessimism around the sort of idea of, like, this explosion of robots and automation as benefiting the global north to the detriment and harm to the global south. Something, you know, if I can turn it in a more positive way for a final note, so it's not just ending on sort of a pessimism, but something that I am, that I see a lot of, and I feel really excited about reading and seeing all of these ideas, is that more and more people are taking a transnational and critical perspective to AI and robotics. I haven't seen it necessarily reflected in the law and policy making that we have so far in Canada, but I certainly see, you know, a greater attention to, awareness of, and openness to the sort of transnational impacts of automated systems, the inequitable global impacts of automated systems. And I think that that seems to be growing in both attention and, you know, how seriously people are taking those concerns. So I think that that is a positive, that I would say in terms of our bigger thinking around AI seems to be just continually expanding and getting more critical. And I think that that is really important.
That's great. Thank you. And of course, the article we've been discussing today is available on the OLR website. But just wrapping up, if our listeners are interested in reading more of your work, where should they find you online?
I have I've tried to post, you know, open access and you know, free versions of articles up on SSRN if there's anything that anyone can't access on through a journal or whatever the case might be. There's sort of preprint versions there. So you can find me on Social Sciences Research Network. I would say you can find me on Twitter slash X, but I am increasingly not on there, so it would be haphazard. And I have a website that's under construction, but it's just kristenthomason.com. And it'll be, you know, up and running soon.
Perfect. And I just wanted to give you one last opportunity if you have any concluding thoughts that you wanted to share with our listeners before we wrap up this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say thanks for having me on. And I guess, like, a concluding thought or message would just be, something that's come up in the conversation, which is just to kind of always be questioning, you know, whose benefit is this actually for, you know, in whose benefit is something being promoted, and will that actually materialize? And I think for those of us who are in the legal sphere, what role can law play as one of many different important mechanisms in guiding some of that process of, you know, hopefully pushing what we are seeing in terms of automation and new developments in the public interest and in an equitable public interest.
Thank you so much, Kristen, for taking the time to meet with us today and to discuss all about AI and robots in the public space. Everyone at the OLR is so appreciative of your time and your continual support to the Law Review.
Thank you.
This concludes this episode of the OLR podcast. I would like to thank our guest, Kristen Thomason, for speaking with us today. Also, thank you to the OLR podcast committee for preparing the questions for this episode, for editing and for transcribing this episode in both English and French. And lastly, thank you to you all for listening.